I told him that, and he just told me it wasn't happening. He told me to fuck off.
What if you had blown the whistle on him? Jen asked.
I tried that before, Jeff said. When I was working for the Senate, no one believed me, and I couldn't prove it.
It's hard to prove, Mutchoff said. It's like proving an intention. It happens in nanoseconds. You'd have to have complete records of everything happening more than once.
I could prove it now, Jeff muttered darkly.
You could, Jen said.
Definitely, most definitely. He was still doing it when we were canned. He's been doing it for years. I took snaps.
Jen stared at them. So, that sounds to me like a good reason to stash you away somewhere. Do you think he did it?
We don't know, Mutchoff said. We talked about it a lot, but we have no way of knowing. Some time had passed, and I'm not sure we really could prove it. And Jeff had just tapped into the CME with his bite and sent a package with the bitten-off points to the SEC, so it's complicated.
Jen thought it over. Okay, get some rest. We've got extra security on this building and on this floor, so you may notice that, but it will just be us. No one is going to be bothering you anymore.
Good.
Next day, Jen got a private pouch delivered to her by hand from Goron's office. The printed lists of letters and numbers were incomprehensible to her. It looked as if some of them were GPS positions, but other than that, nothing. Then, an hour later, Goron dropped by.
Secure room? He asked.
Yes, Faradayed anyway.
Okay. What you're seeing there is a bunch of remotely operated submarines that were visiting the container every 12 hours, coming over from a very busy dock in Queens. So there's not much we can do there without catching one of the subs to help us. There are thousands of people using that dock.
So we're out of luck.
Looks like it. But you mentioned Pincher Pinkerton, so I took a look through the data to see if there were any connections to your case, and found some stuff I thought you'd be interested in. They definitely do security for Alban Albany, and they do personal security for Henry Vincent, too, and they've been tied to a number of disappearances, also to some murders, in the opinion of the FBI. They're on the FBI's top 10 list of the worst security companies, which is a hard list to crack, and a bad sign.
Jen pondered this.
Okay. Thanks, Goron. It will be hard to prove anything about what's already happened,
Goron said.
If it were possible, the FBI would have already stalked them. Your best bet may be to catch them in the act during the next thing they do.
In the 1920s, a plan was proposed to dam and drain the East River from Hellgate to the Williamsburg Bridge, afterward filling in the emptied channel and thus connecting Manhattan with Brooklyn and Queens, while also creating for development approximately 2,000 acres of new real estate.
E. Charlotte. Time came for the co-op members to vote on whether to accept the bid on the building from Morningside Realty, fronting for whomever. Charlotte's half-assed investigations had not been able to crack the facade there, and in any case, no matter who was behind it, the CC&Rs of the co-op required that a vote be taken on matters like this within 90 days of their initiation. And this was day 89, and she wanted no technical infractions to cause trouble later. She had done her best to ask around and get a sense of what people thought, but really, in a building of 40 stories and over 2,000 people, it wasn't possible to catch the vibe just by nosing around. She had to trust that people valued the place as much as she did, and toss the dice as required. In essence, the vote would be a poll, and if they voted to sell, then she would sue them or kill herself, depending on her mood. She was not in a good mood. Many of the building's residents gathered in the dining hall and common room to vote. filling the rooms as they were seldom filled, even during meal hours. Charlotte gazed at the fellow citizens of their little city-state with such trepidation and political distrust that really it seemed like a new kind of fear. Curiosity also was killing her, but there was no way of telling from their faces and manner which way they were going to vote. Most of the faces were familiar, or semi- or pseudo-familiar. Her neighbors. Although they were the only ones who had shown up in person. Anyone in the co-op could vote from anywhere in the world, and this crowd was probably only half the voting membership. Still, the time was now, and if people were voting in absentia, they would have to have already gotten their votes in. So the tally would be finished at the end of the hour. People said what they had to say. Building great, building not so great. Offer great, offer not so great. 4 billion meant around 2 million per co-op member. This was a lot, or it wasn't. Charlotte couldn't stay focused long enough to catch more than the pro or con expressed, leaving the gist of people's arguments to some later time when she might give a shit. She knew what she knew. Get to it, for God's sake. So finally, Mariolino called for a vote, and people clicked their clickers, which were all registered to them, and Mariolino waited until everyone indicated they had done the deed, then tapped his pad such that he had added the votes of those present to the votes of the absentees. Anyone who hadn't voted at this point was simply not part of the decision, as long as they had a quorum, and there was going to be a quorum. Finally, Mariolino looked up at Charlotte and then the others in the room. The vote is against taking the offer on the building. 1,207 against, 1,093 for. There was a kind of double gasp from those in the room, first at the decision, then at the closeness of it. Charlotte was both relieved and worried. It had been too close. If the offer was repeated at a substantially higher amount, as often happened in uptown real estate, then it wouldn't take many people to change their minds for the decision to shift. So it was like a stay of execution. Better than the alternative, but not exactly reassuring. In fact, the more she thought about it, the angrier she got at the half of her fellow citizens who had voted to sell. What were they thinking? Did they really imagine that money in any amount could replace what they had made here? It was as if nothing had been learned in the long years of struggle to make Lower Manhattan a livable space, a city-state with a different plan. Every ideal and value seemed to melt under a drenching of money, the universal solvent. Money, 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 the fake fungibility of money, the pretense that you could buy meaning, buy life. She stood up, and Mariolino nodded at her. As chair, it was okay for her to speak, to sum things up. Fuck money, she said, surprising herself. It isn't all it's cracked up to be, because everything is not fungible to everything else. Many things can't be bought. Money isn't time, it isn't security, it isn't health. You can't buy any of those things. You can't buy community or a sense of home. So, what can I say? I'm glad the vote went against this bid on our lives. I wish it had been much more lopsided than it was. We'll go on from here, and I'll be trying to convince everyone that what we've made here is more valuable than this monetary valuation, which amounts to a hostile takeover bid of a situation that is already as good as it can get. It's like offering to buy realty. That's a rip at any price. So think about that, and talk to the people around you, and the board will meet for its usual scheduled meeting next Thursday. I trust this little incident won't be on the agenda. See you then. After she had spoken with a number of people who came up to commiserate or argue, Vlade approached. It was clear he wanted to talk to her in private, so she made her excuses to the last clutch of residents, who would have been happy to argue all night long, and followed Vlade to the elevators. "What's up?" she said when they were alone.
"Some things have come up you should know about," Vlade said. "So now that you're free, why don't we go up to the farm? Most of the people involved are up there, and Amelia is just about to arrive and tie off her blimp, and she might be a good one to have in on this, too."
"In on what?"
"Come up and see. It will take a while to explain."
He pulled a bottle of white wine from his refrigerator and held it up for her inspection.
"We can also celebrate holding on to the building."
"For now?"
"It's always for now, right?"
She was not in the mood to indulge his Balkan clod-of-earth stoicism, and merely humphed and followed him into the elevator. Up they rode in silence and got off at the farm. Vlade led the way over to the hotelos and called out,
"Knock, knock, we're here to visit."
"Come on in," said a voice.
"Too crowded in there," Vlade replied. "Why don't you guys come out here and we'll drink a toast?"
"To what?"
someone asked, while someone else said,
"Good idea."
Out of the tent emerged the two boys Vlade indulged around the docks, and the old man they had befriended and then rescued from his drowned squat, and then the two men who had disappeared from the farm so many weeks ago.
"Hey," Charlotte said to the two men, "you're back."
Mutt and Jeff nodded. "I'm so glad to see you." She gave them each a brief hug. "We were worried about you. What happened?" Mutt and Jeff shrugged. Vlade said,
"We were over in the Bronx doing some treasure hunting with the boys here, and we found these guys in a container down in the Cypress subway hall."
Charlotte was amazed. "But didn't you, you know?"
"Yeah," Vlade said. "We got the water police to extricate them. They've been checked out at the station. Jen took care of all that. It's been a long couple of days. But now they're back, and I thought we should celebrate."
"We persist in living," Jeff said sardonically.
"Good idea,"
Charlotte said, and sat down heavily on a chair by the railing.
"Plus, we voted to keep this building in our own hands, and won by, like, 2 votes. So, lots to celebrate, yeah."
"Come on," Vlade objected. "There is. Plus, the boys and Mr. Hexter have news, too. Right, boys?"
The two boys nodded enthusiastically.
"Big news," Roberto declared.
They sat around the vegetable cleaning and cutting table, and Vlade uncorked the bottle and poured wine into white ceramic coffee cups. The two boys looked eagerly at him as he did this, and he regarded them, squinting for a second, and then, shaking his head, poured them about a mouthful each.
"Don't start drinking now, boys. There'll be plenty of time for that later."
Roberto snorted at this and downed his shot like an Italian espresso.
"I was a lush when I was 7, he said. "I'm past that now. But I won't say no to a refill,"
holding his cup out to Vlade.
"Quit it," Vlade said.
Then, while the two men were telling Charlotte their tale, Vlade went to the elevator and came back with Amelia Black. She had clearly been weeping on his shoulder, as he was frowning in a pleased way.
"Amelia's back,"
he said unnecessarily, and made introductions all around. Charlotte had only met the Cloud Star once before, and was content to be introduced again, as Amelia didn't seem to recall their earlier meeting, in their conversation over the phone, when Amelia had been trapped in her blimp's closet.
"We're celebrating," Charlotte said grumpily.
"Well, I'm not,"
Amelia said, tearing up again.
"They killed my bears."
"We heard," Vlade said.
Your bears? Charlotte asked. Amelia gave her a bereft look and said,
I just mean, I was the one who took them down to Antarctica. They were my friends.
We heard, Vlade repeated.
Fucking Antarctic Defense League, Amelia said. I mean, there's literally nothing down there but ice.
That's what they like about it, Charlotte supposed sourly. It's pure. And they're pure. Purifying the world is their idea of what they're doing. Amelia was scowling.
It's true. But I hate them. Because it was a good idea to move those bears down there. And it could be temporary, you know? A few centuries. So I want to kill them, whoever they are. And I want the bears down there.
You could always move them in secret, Charlotte suggested. You don't have to tell the whole world about it.
I didn't, Amelia protested. We didn't broadcast live.
But you would have later.
Sure, but not with the location. Besides, do you really think anything happens in secret anymore?
She asked, as if Charlotte were naive. Lots of things happen in secret, Charlotte said. Just ask Mutt and Jeff here.
We were held hostage in a secret location, Mutt explained to the mystified Amelia. 3 months.
I almost died, Jeff said. I'm sorry, Amelia said.
She drained her cup in a single swallow like Roberto.
But now you're back.
And so are you, Vlade reminded her. And the boys helped Mr. Hexter here out of his lodging when it was melting over in Chelsea. So some assisted migrations have worked, you might say. And here we are. We're all here.
Not my polar bears, Amelia objected.
Well, true. That was a disaster for sure. A crime.
It was about 5% of all the polar bears left alive in the wild. And Antarctica is their big chance for survival.
Just do it again, Charlotte suggested again. Do it in secret. Protecting endangered species in secret was a paradigm buster that left Amelia obviously conflicted, or even confused. But at least she was no longer on the verge of weeping. In fact, she was refilling her cup.
It's a good idea, Vlade said in transition. But for now, the boys and Mr. Hexter and I have some news, too.
Charlotte nodded, relieved at the change of subject. She knew Vlade was very fond of their resident cloud star, but to Charlotte, she seemed just as spacey and superficial as she did on her program. Not that Charlotte had ever watched more than 10 minutes of it. Naked starlets wrestling wolf pups. No. So, what's up? She said, we need something better to celebrate than kidnapping, murdered bears, and almost selling our home to some fucking gentrifiers.
Did that happen?
Amelia cried.
It did, Charlotte said grimly. But on the other hand, Vlade weighed in heavily, we didn't take the offer. And the boys here used Mr. Hexter's awesome historical research to locate the wreck of the HMS Hussar.
Which means what? Charlotte asked. The boys were delighted at her ignorance and quickly told her the story. British treasure ship, sunk in Hellgate, searched for ever since, but only Mr. Hexter had pinned the spot where it went down under a drowned parking lot in the Bronx. And the boys had dived it using their own diving bell. Wait, what? Charlotte said. And there it was, right where predicted, but down under 20 feet of mud and landfill, an unwieldy goo, impossible for the boys to dig up on their own. So Vlade had enlisted the help of his friends, Idelba and Tabo, who ran a huge, huge, gigantic sand dredge out at Coney Island. They were moving Coney Island's beach up to the new shoreline 20 blocks north, and for them, digging up the Hussar's treasure chest, actually treasure chests, small but insanely heavy, was nothing. It was toothpick work, and now Idelba and Tabo were part of their consortium, joining the people right here around this table.
Gold?
Charlotte and Amelia said together. Mr. Hexter and the boys explained the story of the British Army's adherence to the gold standard, mark of an earlier age's concept of money. $4 million in gold. In 1780 dollars. Meaning that now, using the median of about 20 inflation calculators Mr. Hexter had found, they were sitting on about $4 billion. Aren't there laws about salvaging sunken treasure? Charlotte asked. There were. But the flood had created so many legal snarls around the intertidal that the laws were no longer so clear as they had been. You ignored the laws, Charlotte said.
We didn't tell anyone, Vlade clarified, so far. And Idelba has a salvage license. But that gold was lost. It was never going to be found. So, you know, if we melted the coins down, it would just be gold bars.
But wait. These gold coins, aren't they more valuable historically than just plain gold would be? And the ship, too. Aren't they archaeological artifacts? Part of the city's history and all?
The ship was smushed, Roberto said. It was all gooed up in the gunk, all rotted and everything.
But the chests and the coins.
They found a cannon of the hussar a long time ago, Vlade said. It was even still loaded. They had to cut the cannonball out of the rust and get the gunpowder out of it so it wouldn't blow up. It's somewhere in Central Park.
So, since we've got that, we don't need the gold coins, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Charlotte shook her head. I can't believe you guys.
Well, Vlade said, look at it this way. How much was that bid on the building here? $4 billion, right? $4.1 billion, didn't you say?
Charlotte said.
We could outbid them.
But it's already our building.
You know what I mean. We could afford to fend them off.
True. Charlotte thought it over. I don't know. It still strikes me as a problem. I'd be very interested to hear what Inspector Jen would say about it. About what we should do with it to normalize it, so to speak. To monetize it. The others said nothing to this. Obviously, consulting a police inspector about the matter did not appeal to them. On the other hand, Inspector Jen was a resident and a known presence. Solid. Polite. Reassuring. A straight shooter. A bit scary, in fact. And now, in more ways than one. Come on, Charlotte said. She would keep it to herself.
Would she?
Vlade asked. I think so. Vlade shrugged, looked around at the others. The boys were round-eyed with consternation. Mr. Hexter, cross-eyed. Mutt and Jeff not yet returned to this planet. Amelia, busy leaving it by way of the wine. Charlotte pinged Jen, found she was down in her room. Jen, could you come up to the farm and give us an opinion on a city issue? A few minutes later, Inspector Jen Octaviasdottir was standing there before them, tall and massive in the dark, hard to see well. They invited her to sit down, and then hesitantly, as if it were some kind of hypothetical case, Vlade and Mr. Hexter explained about the recovery of the hussar's gold. Jen watched them politely as they spoke. So, Charlotte said at the end of their recitation, what do you think we should do about it? Jen continued to look at them, blinking as she regarded them each in turn.
You're asking me?
Yes, obviously, as I just said. Jen shrugged.
I'd keep it. Melt the coins down, sell the gold as needed.
Charlotte stared at her. You would do that?
Yes. Obviously. As I just said.
Slightly slow and pointed with that last sentence, and including a glance at Charlotte.
Sorry, Charlotte said. It's been a long day. But, I mean, melt the coins?
Yes. But what about the what about the what?
What about the law? Roberto said. You're police.
Jen shrugged. I hope you know that the New York Police Department is about more than making lawyers rich. She gestured to Amelia to pour her a cup of wine. Look, if you go public, it will be big news for a week, and then in the courts for 10 years, and at the end of that time, whatever the gold was worth will belong to the lawyers. Charlotte, you're a lawyer. You know what I'm saying.
True.
So why? Just keep it. You could use it to set up a foundation or whatever, buy this building or whatever.
We already own the building, Charlotte complained, still aggrieved by the night's vote.
Whatever. Do some good with it. If it's really $4 billion, you should be able to do something.
$4 billion is just the start of it, Jeff muttered darkly.
What do you mean? Charlotte asked.
Leverage. Monetize the gold. Use it as collateral. Leverage it, like a hedge fund would. Those fuckers are leveraged out 100 times what they start with.
Sounds dangerous, Vlade said.
It is. They don't give a shit.
I hate that kind of thing, Charlotte said.
Of course you do. You're a sensible person. But when you're fighting the devil, sometimes you gotta use the devil's weapons.
There's finance people in the building, Vlade said. The guy that keeps saving the boys. He's kind of a jerk, but he does finance.
Charlotte frowned. Franklin Gar? I like him.
Vlade rolled his eyes at her just like Larry used to back in the day. If you say so. Anyway, he lives here. And he did pull these boys out of the drink a couple of times. We could maybe talk it over with him as a hypothetical situation, see how he seems about it.
That would be interesting, Charlotte allowed.
Although I'm still not sure that you guys should be hiding this gold you found. They all regarded her. Jen was shaking her head and helping Amelia open a second bottle.
Charlotte sighed and gave up on that issue. To her, the rule of law was the last thread holding them all from a fatal plunge into the abyss of anarchy and madness. But there was their Inspector Jen, famous policewoman, a power in the city, a pillar of the Super Venice, happily ignoring this bad fate by conferring with Amelia about vintages of Vino Verde or some such nonsense.
What do you think? Charlotte asked Mutt and Jeff.
Mutt waggled a hand.
Anyone could monetize that gold for you. The hard part is figuring out what to do with it.
And staying out of their clutches, Jeff muttered.
They being?
Jeff and Mutt looked at each other. They were like feral twins at this point, Charlotte thought, dragged out of the woods with their own private language, semi-telepathic and probably barking mad.
The system, Mutt suggested.
Capital, Jeff clarified. It will always win. It will eat your brain.
Not my brain, Charlotte declared.
You say that now, but you're not a billionaire. Not yet.
I hate that shit, Charlotte said. I'd like to crash it.
Me too, Amelia interjected. I want it for the animals.
I want it for this building, Charlotte said grimly.
Mutt regarded her.
So, to save your co-op from a takeover, you would destroy the entire global economic system?
Yes.
Nice work if you can get it,
Jeff pointed out crabbily.
Charlotte glared at him and he raised a hand to ward her off.
Hey, I like the concept. It's just not that easy. I mean, that's what I was trying to do and look what happened.
Did you really try? Charlotte inquired.
I thought I did.
Well, maybe we need to try again, then. Take another angle.
Please, Mutt said.
Jeff scowled.
I will be interested to see this different angle.
Me too. Charlotte looked around at them, stuck out her coffee cup for seconds. Amelia smiled the smile that had made her a cloud star, filled her cup. When they all had gotten refills, they toasted Mutt and Jeff's safe return.
Popeye speaks 10th Avenue's indigenous tongue. Betty Boop speaks in exaggerated New Yorkese. Explained the Federal Writers Project, 1938. Words her biographer claimed first appeared in print in the prose of Dorothy Parker. Art moderne, ball of fire, with bells on, bellyacre, bird brain, boy meets girl, chocolate bar, daisy chain, facelift, high society, mess around, nostalgic, one night stand, pain in the neck, make a pass, doesn't have a prayer, queer, scaredy cat, shoot, the sky's the limit, to twist someone's arm, what the hell, and wisecrack. Hard to believe. New Yorkese is the common speech of early 19th century Cork, transplanted during the mass immigration of the South Irish 200 years ago. Also hard to believe.
F. Franklin. So the building super, Vlade the derailer, came over one morning when he was pulling my bug out of the rafters of his ever more crowded boathouse, leering in what appeared to be his attempt at a friendly smile. Ever since he had dragooned me to save the dock rats from drowning, he'd regarded me as if we were buddies, which we were not, although it would have been nice if he had kept my boat closer to the door as a result of this pseudo-bond. What? I said.
Charlotte wants to talk to you, he said.
So?
So you want to talk to Charlotte?
It doesn't follow.
In this case, it does.
And he gave me a look that had lost all the new bondiness.
You will find it very interesting, he added. Possibly even lucrative.
Lucrative? For me?
Possibly. Certainly for people in this building that you know.
Such as?
Such as the boys you helped me rescue the other week. Turns out they are needing some investment advice, and Charlotte and I are stepping in as their help.
Investment advice? Are they selling drugs now?
Please. They have come into an inheritance, so to speak.
From who?
Charlotte will explain the situation. Can you meet her for drinks after dinner?
I don't know.
You want to do this?
With a Transylvanian look that suggested my boat could be suspended quite high, like up there with the cloud star's blimp on top of the building. All right.
Good. Bottle of wine, up at the farm, tonight at 10.
I'll be there. So I passed the day in the usual multiple temporalities of the screen, so many different chronologies mooshing together that it felt like no time at all. In this no time, I firmed up my impression that the intertidal bubble was getting bigger and thinner, closer to popping. But with winter bearing down at last, the real estate in the drowned zone would freeze in place physically, causing prices to do the same. Volatility suppression by way of extreme low temperatures, a known phenomenon, empirically confirmed in the data and known as freezing prices. Certain kinds of traders devoted to volatility as such didn't like it. Jokes were made about these traders throwing themselves out of skyscrapers because stock prices had gone too stable. So I spent the bulk of my day researching submarine demolition and dockpiling foundations. In the late afternoon, I skimmed home by way of the East River, moving through the alternation of long shadows and lanes of silver sunlight. It was cold, and the river was like a plate of brushed aluminum set under a lead sky. A sight that announced winter and took my mind off Jojo. Or rather, it made me think, ah, now I'm not thinking about JoJo. Damn it, anyway. I turned into 23rd and hummed to the Met, which was still flying Amelia Black's blimp like a big windsock, the late sun burnishing the gilded cupola under it. Gold against lead. Very nice. As I came chugging into the Bacino, homey in its shadows, I found myself in a better mood than when I had left the office. That was something the city could do for you. After a perfunctory dinner in the commons, I went up to the farm floor and found Charlotte already there, with Vlade and the old man that the two boys had taken in, and Amelia Black, the cloud babe, plus a couple of men who looked like hobos. It was explained to me that they were the Quants from our farm who had gone missing, now restored to us. What's up? I said, taking a coffee cup of wine from Vlade. Charlotte clinked her coffee cup with mine. Have a seat, she said, a bit chairpersonistically. We have questions for you. I sat down with Charlotte facing me, and the others sat around us. Amelia Black kept the wine bottle on the floor by her chair. Charlotte said, Our boys, Roberto and Stefan, have inherited some money. Our boys? I inquired. Well, you know, they've become like wards of the building. Is that possible? Anything's possible, Charlotte said, then frowned, as if realizing the inaccuracy of that statement. I suppose I might foster parent them. Anyway, they've inherited a kind of trust fund.
What, are they brothers?
They're like brothers, Charlotte said. Anyway, they're both part of this, and they want us to be part of it. Meaning Vlade, me, and Mr. Hexter, and a couple of Vlade's friends.
And how much are we talking about? I asked.
A lot.
Like, how much?
Maybe a few $1 billion. I could feel my jaw resting on my chest. The others were staring at me as if I were an amusing screen comedy. I closed my mouth, sipped from my coffee cup. Horrible wine.
Who adopted them again?
They laughed briefly at my needlepoint wit. The point is, Charlotte said, still smiling, they want to help the co-op, and they know you and trust you.
Why?
That's what I said.
The others laughed again. The chairperson and I were like a comedy team, although all I could think to say at that moment was, touché, which is never much of a riposte, even though it is a fencing term, but I was still startled by the notion of the squeakers as billionaires.
Joke, Charlotte reassured me. I trust you too. And they said that you've come through every time they've gotten in trouble, and they need financial advice. So I was wondering if you could suggest any way for them to invest this nest egg in a way that is safe but would grow it fast.
I shook my head. Those are opposites. Safe and fast are financial opposites. The two hobo quants nodded at this. Economics won, the smaller one observed, which it was.
Okay, Charlotte said. But finding the right balance between them is what you do, right?
That's right, I said, just a tad patiently, to indicate the oversimplicity of this description. The heart of the problem, you might say, risk management.
So, we were wondering if you would be willing to advise us on a kind of pro bono basis.
I frowned. Typical hedge fund terms are 2% of the amount investment up front, then 20% of whatever I make for you over the market average for that period. 20% of the alpha, as they say.
Right, she said, which is why I asked about pro bono.
But it sounds like they can afford the fee.
They're including the co-op in this deal.
I let her contemplate just how vague that statement was, like meaningless. But she waited me out, looking unrepentant. The others watched me like I was TV. Let's talk hypothetically for a while, I suggested. First, why do you want to put this money in a hedge fund? Because there are more secure ways to invest it.
I thought hedge funds were all about security. I thought hedging meant like hedging your bets. You invest it in ways such that whatever happens, we'll still make money. The shorter of the Quants was snorting in his coffee cup, elbowing his partner, who was stifling a grin. "That's what the term may have meant at some point," I allowed. "At some point in the early modern period. But for a long time now, hedge funds have been about helping investors who have a lot of money, like enough money that they can afford to lose some, to make more than the other forms of investing would make them, assuming things go well. It's high risk, high reward, with some actual hedging going on to reduce the high risk." Charlotte was nodding like she knew this already. "And each hedge fund manager makes different choices in that regard, that are like their trade secret."
"That's right."
"And you work for Water Price and are good at what you do."
"Yes."
"You look like you are,"
Amelia Black tossed in.
"You do too," I said, realizing too late that this could perhaps be understood as a way of saying, "You look like you would be good at hanging from blimps without your clothes on." That didn't seem quite right, but she must have heard versions of this compliment before, as it was kind of true, and in any case, she only smiled her lovely smile. Charlotte aimed a look at Amelia like, "Don't encourage him."
"So," she said, "if you were in charge of the boys' money, what would you do with it?"
"Again, what do they want? And why would you do it this way?"
"What we're ultimately hoping for is that this might allow us to protect the building from any kind of hostile takeover. And for that, we were thinking that
$4 billion might not be enough."
"To buy this building?"
"We own it already."
She too could be just a little patient.
"But to keep it from being bought by a bid so large that the majority of the co-op would take it."
"Ah," I said. "No, $4 billion isn't enough to do that."
"Because there's a lot more out there?"
"Right. Several $1 trillion changes hands every day, or every second." They all gaped except for the two Quants. The smaller of them said, "It's fictional money, but still."
"Fictional money?" Charlotte asked him.
"Paper," he explained. "Loans beyond actual assets, futures and derivatives and instruments of all kinds. Lots of paper that supposedly would convert to money, but that couldn't happen if everyone tried to do it at once."
"That's right," I agreed.
"So you guys are the two Quants who disappeared?"
"We're coders," the smaller one said.
"We're Quants," the taller one said.
"Stop it," Charlotte said.
"Welcome back," I added. She went on.
"So, Frankolino, are you saying that no matter how much we grew this $4 billion, there would be people who had so much more that they could swamp our amount?"
"Yes."
She gave me a look like it was my fault, but I judged it a mock look. She said, "So what would you advise us to do?"
"You could buy the co-op yourselves. Buy it, go private, do what you want. Someone wants to buy your building, you tell them to fuck off."
"Well, okay. That's nice to think there is some kind of an option. Some kind of anti-community privatizing asshole option. Any others?"
"Well," I said, warming to my task, "you could start a hedge fund yourself, leverage the boys' money, and then you're playing with hundreds of billions, which you invest in targeted ways."
Charlotte stared at me as if trying to comprehend some kind of mystery. "And that's what you do?"
"Yes."
"I like that,"
Amelia Black said. Charlotte shook her head hard. "Quit encouraging him. Any other methods you can suggest?"
"Sure," I said. "New instruments are always getting devised. Real estate is always popular because it isn't vaporware. Although in the intertidal, maybe it is. That's my big question right now. The floods case-shillered a tenth of all the real estate in the world to zero. But now my index shows it's almost back to par. So that's been encouraging, maybe even bubblistic."
Charlotte frowned. "So what do we do in this situation?"
"You short it."
"Meaning what?"
"You bet the bubble is going to pop. Buy instruments so that when it does pop, you win. You win so big that the only worry you have is that civilization itself collapses and there's no one left to pay you."
"Civilization?"
"Financial civilization."
"Not the same," she said. "I would love to bring down financial civilization."
You would need to get in line, I told her. I liked the way she laughed. The Quants were laughing too. Amelia was laughing to see the others laugh. She did in fact have a beautiful smile, as did Charlotte, now that I finally saw it. Tell me how, Charlotte said, eyes alight with the notion of destroying civilization, which I had to admit was fun. Think about ordinary people in their own lives. They need stability. They want what you could call illiquid assets, meaning home, job, health. Those aren't liquid, and you don't want them liquid. So you pay a steady stream of payments for those things to stay illiquid, meaning mortgage payments, health insurance, pension fund inputs, utility bills, all that sort of thing. Everyone pays every month, and finance counts on having those steady inputs of money. They borrow based on that certainty. They use that certainty as collateral, and then they use that borrowed money to bet on markets. They leverage out 100 times their assets in hand, which mostly consist of the payment streams that people make to them. Those people's debts are their assets, pure and simple. People have illiquidity, and finance has liquidity, and finance profits from the spread between those two states. And every spread is a chance to make more. Charlotte was regarding me with a laser eye. You're aware you're talking to the chief executive officer of the Householders Union? That's what you do? I asked, feeling suddenly ignorant. Householders was a kind of Fannie Mae for renters and other poor people. The name was aspirational, seemed to me. Some important data from it went into the IPPI as part of the rating of consumer confidence. Charlotte said, That's what I do. But go on, you were saying? Well, the classic example of a confidence crash is 2008. That bubble had to do with mortgages held by people who had promised to pay who couldn't really pay. When they defaulted, investors everywhere ran for the door. Everyone was trying to sell at once, but no one wanted to buy. The people who shorted that made a killing, but everyone else got killed. Financial firms even stopped making contracted payments because they didn't have the money in hand to pay everyone they owed. And there was a good chance the entity they were supposed to pay wouldn't be there next week. So why waste money paying them just because payment was due? So at that point, no one knew if any paper was worth anything. So everyone freaked out and they went into free fall. So what happened? The government poured in enough money to allow some of them to buy the others, and it kept pouring in money until the banks felt more secure and could get back to business as usual. The taxpayers were forced to pay off the bank's lost bets at 100 cents on the dollar, a deal that was made because the top people at the Fed and the Treasury were right out of Goldman Sachs, and their instinct was to protect finance. They nationalized General Motors, a car company, and kept it running until it was back on its feet and paid off its debt to the people. But the banks and big investment firms, they just gave a pass. And then on it went, the same as it had before, until the crash of 2061 in the first pulse. And what happened then? They did it all over again. She threw up her hands. But why? Why? I don't know. Because it worked? Because they got away with it? Anyway, since then it's like they have the template for what to do. A script to follow. So they did it again after the second pulse. And now round 4 may be coming. Or whatever the number, because bubbles go all the way back to Dutch tulips or Babylon. Charlotte looked at the 2 prodigal Quants. Is this right? They nodded. It's what happened, the taller one said lugubriously. Charlotte palmed her forehead. But what does it mean? I mean, what could we do different? I raised a finger, enjoying my moment of one-eyedness among the blind. You could pop the bubble on purpose, having arranged a different response to the crash that would follow. I pointed the raised finger over my shoulder at Uptown.
If liquidity relies on a steady payment stream from ordinary people, which it does, then you could crash the system anytime you wanted by people stopping their payments. Mortgages, rents, utilities, student debt, health insurance. Stop paying. Everyone at once. Call it odious debt default day, or a financial general strike, or get the Pope to declare it the Jubilee. He can do that anytime he wants.
But wouldn't people get in trouble?
Amelia inquired. There would be too many of them. You can't put everyone in jail. So in that basic sense, people still have power. They have leverage because of all the leverage. I mean, you're the head of the householders union, right?
Yes.
Well, think about it. What do unions do? Now Charlotte was smiling at me again, eyes alight. Really an intelligent and warm smile. They strike. Exactly.
I like this, Amelia exclaimed. I like this plan.
It could work, the taller Quant said. He looked at his friend. What do you think? Does it meet with your approval?
Fuck yes, the smaller one said. I want to kill them all. Me too, Amelia said.
Charlotte laughed at them. She picked up her cup and held it toward me, and I lifted mine and we clinked them together. Both cups were empty.
Another glass of wine, she suggested.
It's terrible.
I take that as a yes.
Yes.
Early in 1904, three of Coney Island's elephants broke out of their enclosure and ran away. Gee, I wonder why. One was found the next day on Staten Island, and therefore must have swum across the lower bay, a distance of at least 3 miles. Did we know elephants could swim? Did this elephant know elephants could swim? The other two were never seen again. It's a pleasure to think of them skulking around in the scrawny forests of Long Island, living out their lives like pachydermous yetis. But elephants tend to stick together, so it's more likely the other two took off swimming with the one that was found on Staten Island. Not such a pleasure, then, to imagine them out there together, dog paddling, soulfully west through the night, the weakest eventually slipping away with a subsonic goodbye, then the next weakest, lost at sea. There are worse ways to go, as they knew. In the end, the surviving one must have lumbered up onto the night beach and stood there alone, trembling, waiting for the sun.
G. Amelia. Amelia banged around New York for a few days, too angry and distracted to do anything. At first, she liked Franklin from the building, a good-looking man, but he thought she was a simpleton, so then she didn't like him. She saw a few friends and talked over projects with her producers, but nothing appealed to her, and everyone agreed that she was probably not going to do a very good job of hosting an entertaining program about assisted migration when the main thing she talked about now was capturing and jailing everyone in the Antarctic Defense League, or, alternatively, killing them dead. Amelia, you've got to stop with that, Nicole said. If you can't stop feeling it, you at least have to stop saying it. But my audience knows I say what I feel. That's why they watch my show. And right now, I'm post-traumatic. I know. So you have to stop feeling it. But I feel what I feel. Okay, I get that. So let's get you feeling something else. So they went ice skating. A polar vortex had struck the area the week before, and it was still cold out. Very cold. In fact, it felt much colder in Manhattan than it had on the Antarctic shore. That shore where her Urson brothers and sisters had been most foully murdered. It was so cold that the whole of New York Harbor had frozen over. People were now driving trucks on the canals and over the Hudson to Hoboken, and even all the way out the Verrazano Narrows, as the sea surface was frozen about 2 miles out from there. From time to time, the Hudson's ice cracked, and big plates of it shoved up and tilted at the sky, looking just like the ice in dreadful Antarctica. She couldn't shed those memories. The canals of Lower Manhattan were frozen so solid, there was barely a crack in the ice. So it was as if the streets had come back, this time white, and slippery, and considerably higher than before. But in any case, there to walk on, simple as that. Well, nothing was ever simple in the city. There were warm spots where machinery or some other source of heat remained down in the subways or sewers or utilidors of the undercity. And these plumes were warm enough to make the ice over them thin or, in a few well-known locations, not there at all. At these liquid pools in the general ice, the harbor seals popped up for air. Also the beavers and muskrats and other estuarine animals. Breathing while hoping not to get killed and eaten by predators, human or otherwise. Really, the world was such a horrid place. It was so often kill or be killed. Eat some of your neighbors and then get eaten by others. Nicole was acting weird, like Amelia was some kind of bomb that might go off. And any boyfriend she had ever had in New York had left town, or was too unhappy or unhappy-making to reconnect. Really, there was nothing to do. And so, there they were. Ice skating. Actually, it was kind of fun. In her childhood, Amelia had learned to skate on ponds and rivers, so she could handle the canal's rough patches and skate backward, which was fun, and even twirl a little. Although that was not so fun, as it reminded her of when her mom had made her do things for contests. Her mom had been a stage mom, and Amelia supposed she had to be grateful now that she was a performing artist, but she wasn't. She did, however, like to ice skate. So she skated with Nicole up and down Broadway, from Union Square to 34th, feeling the chill air in her lungs, nose tingling, feeling all the glorious feelings of being out in winter under a pale sky, the sun just barely clearing the horizon to the south, casting long shadows to the north from all the buildings. It was like they had all been transported to an ice planet somewhere, and yet there were the same familiar buildings and delis and kayak stores, with the only difference being the canals were a solid, if dirty, white. The city had even put some real buses back on the streets. Old buses with new motors. That made the views up and down the street canyons look like old photos, but with ice skaters replacing taxis. Walkers had to stay near the buildings or risk the fate of inattentive jaywalkers during the old days. Amelia skated at speed, going faster than the taxis of earlier times would have been able to, because she could dodge through traffic like a motorcyclist. Nicole could not keep up with her. If someone walked in front of her, she yelled, "Beep, beep, beep," and dodged them with inches to spare. But then she found herself going so fast that she accidentally skated through a stretch of red tape, crossing the intersection of Broadway and 28th, and below her, the ice got thin. And she thought of her father saying, "Skate fast over thin ice." But even skating as fast as she could, the ice broke under her. Not only was she dumped instantly into cold water, but a broken chunk of ice caught her right under the ribs and knocked the wind out of her just as she plunged completely under. The shock of the cold would have driven the air from her lungs anyway, but it was already gone. So she choked, and in doing so, took some water into her lungs. So she coughed and choked again. And then she was drowning. Flailing, panicking, she swam hard upward and banged into ice. There was a clear ceiling of ice between her and the air. She had slid under the unbroken ice, and now would drown for sure. A huge adrenaline surge shot through her body, turning her blood to fire and making her more desperate than ever for air. She elbowed the ice above her as hard as she could, but it was a weak blow. Now, she was only seeing a blur of blacks and grays. She didn't know what to try next, where to swim next. She knocked the back of her head up against the ice. That hurt, but nothing more happened. She was doomed. Then, there was a loud crashing around her, and she was grabbed and dragged upward by she knew not what. There she was, hanging in the air, dragged sideways, held up by several people moving around her and shouting. She was gasping, freezing, coughing, choking, drowning, still, although in the air, and being shuffled away from a big, jagged, wet hole in the ice, which these passers-by had apparently bashed to get to her. They had seen her under the ice, they told her loudly, seen the accident, and followed her.